first of all, I have to disappoint Paul. There won't be any pictures of Kevin in this. I know you wanted to know before. No, this will be about aspects of lean pairs and loaders and binary formats. So lots of stuff that usually happens in the background that nevertheless is occasionally relevant for the stuff we actually do. Looking at how we usually write our software, so we write all our fancy template meta programming code that Ivan just showed us. We run a compiler, of course, that will work on first attempt. Then some magic happens, and we run the application, and the main method will be called, and everything will just work, right? So, why should we bother is the stuff that happens between the object files generated and main is called. Well, first of all, occasionally that goes wrong, so we get link errors. That is good to know where they are coming from. Even though there might be bizarre runtime behavior due to mismatching library or a plugin that's not loaded. So, again, knowing what's actually happening there helps us to deal with these problems. Similar is performance, so if we understand how this actually works, it helps us to write better and faster code. And then, yeah, if you, I guess most of you work with the CMake and ECM, so lots of the details are nicely hidden from us, but if you're ever in a situation where you actually have to do this by hand, or as an inferior build system, then you need to know how to enable all of you. All the details. CMake isn't that bad in that regard, they actually set most of those flags as well. So yeah, let's look at what actually happens between compiler generates the object file and main gets called. So this is basically two parts. There's one part at build time, so that's linking, assembling all the object files into a shared library or an executable. And then more interesting stuff at runtime. You need to find all your shared libraries somehow. You need to load them into memory somehow. You need to figure out where the functions you're using are coming from external libraries and how to call them. And then you eventually actually need to get to so we're going to go through all these steps in a little bit more detail. And look at what's happening there regarding typical error scenarios or performance aspects that are relevant for what we are usually doing. So let's start with linking. The most common error you get there, right, is undefined reference to some method. You probably all have seen this. The fact that you get that error at all is due to the non-standard linker arguments that it actually should give you an error about this. So if you just run GCC and LD manually, you might not even see that error. And most of the time, it's quite obvious what that means, right? So you're using a function, but you forgot to implement it, or you forgot to add the C++ file to CMake. So the header is there, it looks like you can use it, but the code isn't actually, it's not actually generated. But there's some more subtle errors, like signature mismatches, or issues with the exporting. And for that, it's quite useful to be able to actually look into libraries or executables and see what's actually in there and what's the linker complaining about. You probably have seen those tools already on Linux. That's all part of binutils. So you have NN, readelf, and object dump. They have a largely overlapping feature set. On Mac, there's O2 that does most of this together. And on Windows, there's a fancy UI dependency walker that kind of does this. And if we run something like NM on, I think that was 3 core add-ons, you get an output like this. And it's random numbers, some letters, some weird strings that vaguely contain the class names you're using. The first part is just the offset, so that's largely uninteresting. We're going to see now what the letter and this real name is supposed to mean there. Historically, when all this started with C, in C you don't have overloading and templates and namespaces and so on. So the way stuff was identified there is by just using the function name. But then on the move to C++, that wasn't really enough anymore. So this name rendering was handled or invented. And that's the weird thing we saw there. And that involves additional stuff to uniquely identify a method or a variable, including the types of the arguments, anything related to templates, namespace, const qualifiers, all that kind of stuff, on Linux at least. On Mac, it also includes the library name itself, which fixes a whole bunch of problems you can have on Linux. There is clashing names in two different shared libraries. So if you have ever debugged a problem where your singleton constructor was executed twice after learning a plugin, that won't happen on Mac. But that also means you can't do all those nice early keyword tricks that are very popular for tooling, like the tool Emilia is going to show. And then there is Windows, destroying even more fun. They also include the private protected public qualifiers in the symbol name, which means that the very popular or once popular defined private public click to call private methods got out of fashion because the public's been complaining that this doesn't link on Windows. And this explains why. For the compiler, you suddenly have a method that's public. So it generates a manual symbol containing the public in a name for calling it. But at the meantime, you will notice that the library actually has the private encoded in the name, and so this doesn't match anymore. But that's, of course, something that's very hard to see in a undefined reference to something. But if you know this and look at the stuff in the library, right? So you see the difference there. And of course, you don't need to look at the weird language things. There's tools like C++ field or the dash capital C argument for them, that automatically does that for you. And then you get the human readable name again. And you will see that, okay, there's a const missing, and here I have a const, so maybe I'm linking against the older library on disk or something like that. And then you have the small letter in the NM output. That's related to exporting of symbols. So by default, if you run GCC and manually compile the library, every function you have in there will be accessible from the outside, usable from the outside, or exported. That makes things more easy, but it's not necessarily the most same default, so ECM sets that to default visibility hidden. So by default, everything will not be visible from the outside. That's why we have to do the export macros in front of every class that's supposed to be used from the outside. And what this does for GCC, it's just setting this lengthy attribute there, which tells GCC to actually export that symbol. That would be super easy if Windows wouldn't break it again. You know that you need to do this one export macro per library. That's because on Windows you not only have to mark symbols you want to export to the outside, you also have to specifically mark all symbols that you want to use from another library as an import macro. But of course, the library, or the headers of your library, are both used to compile the library, in which case you need the export module, and then used by the users of the library, in which case you need the import module there. So that's why this is all wrapped in a macro that dynamically switches this, depending on if you're building the library or using the library. And again, that's all hidden by the generated export headers and CNAIC switching or defined depending on if you're building or using. But if the topics complain about something not blinking on Windows, most often that's the reason for it. And in the MM output, the middle column, the single letter, if that's uppercase, it means it's exported. If it's lowercase, it means it's not exported. So if you get a linker error for a symbol that's there with a matching signature, and you have a lowercase letter in the library, you just forgot the export macro. Okay, then the files that are actually generated there for short libraries or executables, that's ELF on Windows, Mac on Mac, and TE portable executable on Windows, they are more or less the same. There's minor details on what's actually in there, but they are surprisingly similar, and they are very, very simple. Usually there's just a single header file that defines a bunch of structs. And the way you pass them is you map the whole thing into memory and you cast the random pointer to that struct, and that's it. So it's also readable with an executor. And they're essentially the same for executables and libraries. There's one particularly example that shows how similar they are. If you have a Qt 5 core SO, try executing that. That will give you some debug output on the version of Qt, at least on Linux. And the reason why this works is the only two things missing usually in a library is the information on the interpreter that actually runs the program, and an entry point. The entry point is usually name. For library, there isn't one, but there's a linker argument which allows you to set that to an arbitrary function. So if you want to write a program that doesn't have name as the entry point, that's also easily possible. But that's more esoteric stuff. Right, and those files basically consist of a bunch of sections, some standard sections like the list of all functions that are in there. That's basically what MM is dumping you out. Then usually a section that is called text, which refers to actually assembler code, and some data like strings or key resource data. And you can also have custom sections. And that's something newly used in Qt 5. In Qt 4, we were using the desktop files for plugin meta information. So you could actually query the available plugins or its dependencies and versions and so on without actually loading the plugin into memory. And the way it's done now is you have a custom section in those plugins that contains a binary QJSON object which contains all the metadata. So we don't have to have the second file next to the plugin anymore. The actual implementation is all in mock-generated code, so you usually don't get to see this. But if you have this problem that your plugin is apparently found, but for some reason it doesn't really want to load it, it can be quite useful to know what you need to check if it's actually present in order to debug this. So there is Qt plugin metadata symbol. That's actually in a custom section .qt metadata. And you can move stuff to custom sections just by using some lengthy attribute syntax. Again, that's hidden in macros in Qt, so you don't really see that. But you can use tools like regref to list all sections in there. So if the Qt plugin metadata section is missing, something is apparently wrong, what isn't generating the code, and that explains why it's not detected as a plugin. And the second part you need to look for in plugins is the entry point. So the method that the Qtdemo logger is calling to obtain the actual object that your plugin is creating, that's Qtdemo instance. And that needs to be present and it needs to be exported. Otherwise, it's not callable from the outside. Again, if that's not there, it's usually not that you forgot to add the export macro because Mock is doing that. More likely is that you forgot to have the necessary macros in the plugin file itself, so Mock wasn't actually generating this in the first place. But if it's not there, the Mock file contains the code that actually uses this, and you can check in the binary if it's present. Something that, right, there might be a dash D for listing the dynamic section in NN. I think that, because there's the symbol table and the dynamic symbol table, and you need the writer, and that's not always the default in the tools, but yeah, that's right. Right, and what is kind of missing here, or what we lost from moving from desktop files for this, is an easy way to actually read the metadata. I have a little tool to plug in for that actually dumps you the JSON data in there. It's like 20 lines of code. Is published next to the slide, so link is on the last slide. That's probably something worth upstreaming to do to just look at the details in there. Okay, then another custom section we have in libraries or executables is the debug data. That format is called Dwarf, and it's much more complicated than Elf, but you don't really have to deal with that. I mean, this is purely for GBDC use. But you might not have a problem when attaching GDB to a large application or launching a large application in GDB. That just takes a lot of time. And that's from parsing all those debug information. There is, however, a trick to massively speed that up by pre-indexing the debug data. You can do that the hard way using the save GDB index command in GDB while having the library loaded, and then using the object copy tool to inject that as a custom section into your library. Or you use Gold, which already comes with a GDB index linker to know that it does that for you. I also have a script next to the slide that does mass indexing for a whole bunch of libraries. We measured that, I think, Kevin did it on KDevelop. Startup time went down from 25 to 30 seconds to 5 seconds. And I tested it on a WebKit2 test application, and then it went down from 40 seconds to 5 seconds. So that's worth it, right? The object copy tool, despite the name, is actually far more flexible. It's also part of Binmeters. That's the universal tool to actually get extra sections in or out, or look at the content or modify them. So that comes in handy for some other stuff as well. Okay, so let's move from build time to runtime. First thing you have on the list there is finding the libraries that need to be loaded. And that's actually a surprisingly complicated process because there's so many different ways on how you can specify where to look for libraries. The four points I have on the list here are actually massively simplifying it. That's the common scenario, but there's a whole bunch of more exotic ways to influence this. And then, of course, there's minor details on the order of stuff in any of those variants. But basically, there's four things to look at. There's R-pass and run-pass. Those are fields inside the library that contains a list of search paths. CNAG again handles all of those paths using the R-path linker option to set it. And I think the default option is actually to set it to the build directory and rewrite it while installing, which is quite convenient because it allows you to run from the build directory or after installing, still finding your dependencies without any other interference. But of course, if anything goes wrong there and you pick up the wrong library, you might have outdated code or incompatible code loaded in the same time. So debugging this, that comes in handy to do, to know where it might be looking for it. So R-pass, that's kind of deprecated if run-pass is present. That has the highest priority, but our default has run-pass present, so that's no longer the first thing to look at. Instead, in, I guess, our normal setup, every library pass in the environment variable is the first thing to look at. Then at the run-pass field in the library, because we have the NLU2DX linker flag set by ECM, so we actually have run path. And if it's not found in there, you have a whole bunch of defaults in your ETC directory. And this is all nice theory, right? Who knows what's actually looking for the stuff in reality? So there's a bunch of diagnostics. The first two are for looking at it without actually executing the program, so just statically. ADD is probably the most well-known one. That basically just gives you a list of all libraries that will be loaded and the exact path on where they are taken from. And then there's readelf-d. That's dumping you the information containing R-path and run-path of a specific library. So if you want to check if it's still pointing to build directory or install directory, or if it's present at all or contains an outdated path in your setup that is no longer useful, that's the way to check it. And you also have ways to actually observe what's happening at runtime. There's the LDDebug environment variable from the dynamic linker. That actually has a whole bunch of options you can set for performing stuff in far more detail than this. But the most basic one is libs, and that basically shows you where it's looking for stuff and why it's loading a library from that specific location. So it's not only giving you the path, it also tells you, I'm using this because one path in that library points to this path, and I didn't find it in any library path. And then, of course, we have strace, which is just the universal tool for observing any kind of IO. That especially also shows you all the failed attempts to find stuff anywhere. So if you probably have that scenario, like where you change some code, you run it, you don't see any change, you have some more debug output, you run it, you still don't see your debug output, you bang your head against your desk for an hour, and then you notice that you're running like accidentally an installed library instead of the one you have in your build directory. If you don't see the effect of your changes, check if you're actually using the code you just wrote. So once we have found our libraries, they are loaded into memory. And the way this is done is they're mapped. So this is, I guess you know roughly how that works, right? So you have a memory region that to your application looks like the entire library is in memory, but it's actually still completely on disk, and only if you actually access data like a 4 kilobyte page around that point is actually loaded into memory. And it's not MFS the full library, but it's usually in three different areas. One is read-only data, like key resources and stuff like that. One is read-only and executable, so that's the actual program code. And then you have one that is also writable, so for any kind of other data. The read-only sections are shared between processes. So if you have 100 applications running using Qt Core, and they all access the giant MIME database that we put into Qt Core, they will only be in memory exactly once, right? So this is fine. If you have writable data in the library, that's per process. It's copy and write. So initially, it's also just. Oops. Okay, there's a break afterwards, so I can feel free to a few more minutes. Sorry. So, yeah, as soon as you write it, the whole data is copied in memory, so that's the part you want to keep really, really small. So, how does this actually look like in a real library? This is Qt Core. The tool to generate that image is also linked to that on the last slide. You have the read-only data, that's this block. This is the actual code. And the writable data is this tiny blue line here, so it's actually a sensible distribution. One part that's interesting here is this big part is QList, QVector, and QHash because they exist in many, many different copies, being templates. There is a few ways to avoid those, well, not the different instances, but you will find the same thing in the other Qt libraries as well. QList of int exists in basically all of them. There is ways to counter this with the C++11 extern template. The problem is for that you would need to export it, which counters all attempts at actually not exporting any of the templates. So there it would need some evaluation if this is actually a problem or if the extra exported signals are worth it to reduce the code size anywhere else. So we have to skip the details there, I guess. So the most important part regarding size there is minimize the size of the writable section, right? Any unused code isn't loaded into memory, so it's wasting this space, but it's not actually how many you're sent for read-only data. Just writable data that will be copied into each process. So we have a bunch of ways of declaring a random string variable there. I have to skip some of the details. You see that the array notation ends up as marked as R in NN. R is read-only data. D is writable data. And D is uninitialized writable data. So that has the same impact on memory usage, but it just doesn't appear on disk. So prefer ways like this where stuff ends up in the writable section. String literals always end up there, so this one, the first one ends up in data, but just the pointer, not the actual string literal itself. So you're wasting 8 bytes, not the data for the entire string. But as soon as you have far more complicated data structures, that of course becomes relevant. And that's also where C++11 const expression constructors come in, because that allows you to put more and more stuff into read-only data, which then is shared and saves you actual process memory. But with stuff in read-only memory, what happens if you do this? Like as long as the stuff is const, the compiler prevents us from changing it, but of course, I can bypass that. Any idea what What happens if I do this? It crashes, right? Segmentation fault on that pointer. Pointer looks valid in GDB, so as with any other memory corruption issue, Vagrant is your best choice there. And that actually explicitly tells you that permission on that area. And what that means is you actually have a read-only data from the library that you host casted. Okay, and then the final part, and that's the most tricky one in all this, the dynamic library business. How do I know how to call a function in a different library when I don't know where that library ends up in memory? And there's two mechanisms built in for this. There's the procedural linkage table, that's kind of like tiny dummy functions or function stubs that you call instead inside your library, which is just a relative jump, so that's easy. And that then uses the global offset table, which is filled by the dynamic linker to find out where the function actually is, and then it calls into this. So you have basically two ways of calling a function. If it's in the same library, it's just relative jump directly to that code, otherwise you have a level of indirection. Usually you don't notice any of this, and it has maybe tiny performance impact. At least until we got to contact to member function connects in Qt 5. You know how the old connect worked, right? You have the sender and the string name of the signal, and that was compared to the mock data if that's actually a signal in the same object. And that's still how the new connect works. It gets a pointer to the signal function, and it compares that with the data in the mock data if that's actually a signal in that object. But if you now have different ways of calling the same function, you might end up with pointers to entirely different things that effectively do the same thing, but if you compare them, the comparison fails, right? And that means your connect breaks. This is addressed by the position independent code, position independent executable flags that again seem like sets for us, and Qglobal actually enforces, so you get a compiler telling you build with the pick or pull flag, and on x86 that works perfectly fine. On ARM, and as I learned yesterday from Albert, apparently also on PowerPC64, there's interesting toolchain bugs, but this doesn't work. And there's next to the slides a little bit of example code that demonstrates this. Without knowing that all this magic happens in the background, it's basically impossible to debug because the bug is in code that the linker had generated, code which GDB doesn't allow you to step into, code you have never seen anywhere. It's just doing stuff that is unexplainable. There's a workaround, that's the Pine linker flag. So if you're working on ARM or PowerPC, that magically makes your correct statement, so, or use like the latest two changes. Yep, and I'm done. So yeah, CNET hides most of this from us, but if you have any problems in that area, it's kind of useful to know what actually happens in a record. I have all the stuff I was referring to, scripts here, and that's the most comprehensive document there is, explaining all the low-level details on how this works. Yeah, sorry for running so late.